I'm George Liston, CA.
The enduring fact of the Holocaust and of the psychopathic leader who orchestrated its horrors continue to occupy us. The challenge of understanding what happened remains. As vexing and as important is why it happened, and the precise relationship between man and event, idea, and resultant atrocity. In Hitler and the Holocaust, Martin Wank provides an original and significant new interpretation, tracing profound and menacing chords of history and tying them to the charismatic madman who harvested resentment like a gardener in an already planted garden of disaster. And my guest today is Martin Wank, author of Hitler and the Holocaust, The Hidden Story. Martin, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you.
It's quite a book. And it gives us a new understanding of Adolf Hitler. And let's go right to that point, Martin, I think is where we have to start. Many, maybe most people, have tended to portray Adolf Hitler as the consummate evil genius, the mastermind of malice, whipping up the post-war resentment the Germans felt and building that into the cauldron of World War II. Against that, and correct me if I'm wrong, I got from this book a very different kind of Hitler. The Hitler of this book is a repulsive creature, rodent-like, stinking of brimstone. I remember that very vividly from one, with a kind of pulp fiction mind, who, and this may be the most important point of all, who rides the wave of a tremendous century-old social force. Tell me if that's right. And more importantly, Martin, why did you even get the idea of trying to go against the grain or taking a new look at Hitler?
Well, first of all, George, that's right. Second, you know that I once wrote a book about Freud.
Right.
And I had to study 19th century history. And I had to discover why Freud created this system of psychoanalysis and what it meant. I found that in looking at the Hitler story, I was looking at the same background. Mm. It's quite simply that Freud went one way and Hitler went another way. Mm. Freud was born 1856. Hitler was born 1889. They're roughly in the same area. They had very similar historical backgrounds behind them. Mm-hmm. The question was always with these characters and many others, what to do about what happened in Europe?
Right.
And they came up with varying answers. And the first book, as you know, was called Freud's Answer.
Right.
Freud responded to what was happening. Mm-hmm. Hitler responded also in a very different way.
Let's go into that, because what you're telling me and by extension those listening is that it's really the social, political, historical forces of the 19th century
yes.
that shaped these men.
I believe so.
And Hitler, obviously, in a very, very perverse way.
Yes.
So, Martin, the obvious question now is what were those forces? What are we talking about? What is so powerful about that century?
The French philosopher, Michel Foucault, the late philosopher who died not long ago, said that about the year 1800, mm-hmm. everything changed and we began to think in new ways.
1800.
1800 mm-hmm. marks roughly the Industrial Revolution and the Democratic Revolution, the French Revolution, which became the Democratic Revolution, mm-hmm. which started to spread all through Europe.
Right.
This was superimposed on basically a medieval feudal world, a world that had not been changing much. All mm-hmm. of a sudden, it changed dramatically.
In two ways, industrialization and politically and democracy.
Yes, okay. And these created urbanization.
And democratic capitalism.
And capitalism, mm-hmm. and the free market, a much more widespread trade. However, what it did at the same time was kill a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It killed the old village communities that had existed in Europe for 2,000 years, mm-hmm. probably since the fall of Rome. It killed religion. Religion in the 19th century was on a spiral downward.
Right.
It killed any sense of spirituality because what happened in the 19th century, materialism became the big thing.
What a quick question on that, yeah. Martin. I get the sense of the death of a lot of, quote, old certainties.
Yes, indeed, old certainties. Among those certainties even was personal identity.
Right.
In the pre-industrial world, you knew who you were, even if you were a serf. In the new world, where everything was loosened, you didn't even know who you were or where you were, what you were doing there.
Another question on this, Martin. The way you describe it with that sort of a very dramatic curtain opener of 1800, it sounds abrupt. I mean, it doesn't. Obviously, there's transitions, but it seems to me to be pretty quick. This goes on.
It was the most abrupt change in the history of the world. I once mentioned this to someone, and they said, "You know, that can't be because history just goes on and on, and it just sort of changes, and it's no, it doesn't quite. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it does that, but sometimes it doesn't. In 1800." A kind of a curtain came down,
right.
A kind of a change took place that was more dramatic than anything that had ever happened before. The pace of change in the 19th century and in the 20th century that we've been living through is something that nobody ever saw before.
This is true. I think no one would question that. The question then, though, is why did Germany react the way it did to it? I mean, of course, the message of the book is that these changes come in as powerfully and as abruptly as you just pointed out, but that the German reaction to them, to this dislocation, might be a word for it, I suppose, is itself dramatic and negative.
One of the ways modernization, which is what we're really talking about, came to Germany was on the bayonets of Napoleon in 1805, 1806. So it came as a as an attack, as an imperial venture of the French against the Germans. Mm-hmm. The French were carrying their banners of égalité, fraternité, and all the themes of the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. The Germans said, wait a second, the rhetoric is very nice, mm-hmm. but you're killing a lot of Germans. You seem to want to take over Germany mm-hmm. and make it a part of France in a kind of an imperial grab. The Germans got very mad about that. Mm-hmm. So the Napoleon's attack is one of the things that turned the Germans against modernity.
Right.
But that was not the only factor.
That's condemning the message because you also dislike the messenger, but there's more.
Yes.
There's more. Let me try this.
No, yeah, go on.
The romanticism of the Germans for the feudal past, is that?
No, yes. The Germans were not a unified nation.
Right.
They were made up of, before Napoleon attacked, they were made up of maybe 300 separate entities. Mm-hmm. Napoleon consolidated them into 30. But all of these were very old-fashioned princelings and dukedoms and counts. What is accountancy? I don't know.
Being Americans, we'll call it accountancy. Yeah, people
right.
know what we mean.
And they were all old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. And the peasants were even more old-fashioned than the leaders. Mm-hmm. The modernization came to them much more than to France or to England, certainly, or to America, as a shock.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Are you saying from the peasants up or everyone? Or?
From the peasants up, even up to to the rulers.
Right.
Modernization meant that you were eventually going to be out of a job.
That's right. It's right in the monarchies.
Yeah, and we can relate this to modern times with the Arabs later.
I'm going
to
come to that.
If we get to them.
Okay.
They're old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. They were romantic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They saw coming over a kind of rationalist, industrialist kind of society mm-hmm. that they did not like.
Yeah.
They liked nature. They liked agrarian life. They liked the old ways. They really did.
Yeah, well, this was what resonates with me in the book. I'm fascinated by Germany for good reasons and reasons that relate to some terrible parts of the history. But it's, and I hope I cite this correctly, the romanticism of that I associate with Germany, the wandering, the Volk myths and so forth, mm-hmm. and this kind of nostalgic attachment to a past. I mean, making a kind of a golden age out of feudalism. So I guess the sense that psychologically they just didn't want to accept this as, the fact that things could change this abruptly, that they would lose that kind of mythic German notion of themselves.
They thought they were going to lose it all.
Uh-huh.
And they were going to lose, as just as you said, Germanism.
Mm-hmm.
Their being, their Germanness was going to go out the window.
Explain that term. It comes in the book in several places. Germanism, that's the first time I've seen a country become an ism of its own. So what did it mean, Germanism?
Oh, well, it meant a lot of things. In addition to Germans and Germany,
mm-hmm.
you've got something that's called Germanic.
Right.
Something that's called Germanist and something that's called Germanism. These people were kind of developing a theory
mm-hmm.
out of who and what the Germans were. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
The Germans were this past-loving people, this people that loved the Middle Ages, this people that was the chosen people of all the crazy things in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Mm-hmm.
They were told in the 19th century, forget about the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
You are the chosen people. You are the people of the future.
Yeah.
Huh? You are the master race.
Mm-hmm.
You ought to conquer Poland and Russia and clean it out and put in good Germans in there.
I think it's important for you to repeat right now. We're talking about the 19th, not the 20th century.
We are talking about the 19th century exactly. What happens in the discussions of these things is people put them up too late.
Uh-huh.
They talk about the 20th century without recognizing all of this was cooking in the 19th century.
Okay, this is the main theme of the book, I think.
Yes.
These are the preconditions for Hitler. We're
setting
the stage. It's like, I mean, as I finished the book, I said, if you want a metaphor for this, it's like you put the scenery on the stage and you have the actor come in and
exactly
and do his
right.
roles.
It's just say, yeah.
Here it is.
Start the action.
Right, right. In fact, to make this connection, I think, really potent, I got the impression, I'm getting a little bit ahead of the book and our conversation, but you take this romanticism, all these notions of the 19th century, and you're quite right about, I mean, for example, the anti-Semitism could be accompanied, I mean, everything was sort of turned on its head. You could, be anti-Semitic and then say, no, we are the chosen people, and use the biblical imagery to justify your own
mm-hmm.
claims. This is going on. But romanticism plus nationalism ultimately are the formula for Nazism, it almost seems like. I mean, you get this
yes.
this kind of blending, if you will,
yeah,
that
yeah.
starts out.
Nazism and fascism in Europe was romantic right-wing politics.
Right. Yeah.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
It was true in Austria. It was true in Germany. It was true in Italy. And, you know, fascism spread through Europe in the 30s. And
mm-hmm.
all of them wore these romantic types
mm-hmm.
that thought that they could put a stop to the changes in the world, changes
mm-hmm.
that the romantics and reactionaries didn't like.
Right.
Huh?
Right.
They thought that the world was becoming meretricious.
Yeah.
It wasn't for them.
Yeah. You know, one of the great things about the book is it makes the reader think, you know, and you say, you find the argument compelling as you read, and then you say, for example, on this point, rejecting industrialism and this romantic predisposition to try to turn the clock back. But it's also true, Martin, isn't it, that Germany would, through that century and the 20th, become a major industrial power.
Yeah, this is a very interesting point. In Germany unified in 1871,
mm-hmm.
Between 1850 and that unification, it was already becoming one of the great industrial powers of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And it went on to become, indeed, the industrial power of the continent. They didn't surpass the United States,
mm-hmm.
and they did more or less surpass England, I guess, in a lot of indices. However, if you want to be old-fashioned, what do you do about the technology and the industry and the finance and all the things and the free market economy and the trade that makes you this great industrial power? Well, it was a great problem for the fascists. They had to think about this. And I just want to insert here that in the 1920s, a group of fascist writers sprung up in Germany and they said, we are going to revise the doctrine of fascism. Technology is okay.
These guys are amazing.
All of a sudden, technology was okay and it could be considered German.
Mm-hmm.
It was all right. Now, they needed technology to fight wars, which they wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to whip everybody in the world. They needed technology. So they developed a rationale
mm-hmm.
that the modern world wasn't good, but technology was. Can I just go back just a bit?
Mm-hmm.
There's something in the book that I think, among what I think are original insights, there's a point I make that I've never seen anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with the American Civil War mm-hmm. and the antebellum South.
Yes, uh-huh.
I would like to make this point, if I may. What the plantation economy mm-hmm. of the American South was trying to do mm-hmm. was institute and retain a pre-industrial world on American soil. Mm-hmm. They, the plantation owners, were lords on the model of medieval barons and counts and whatever. The slaves were on the model of the serfs. Mm-hmm. Many of the Irish plantation owners developed a fake genealogy that went back to the Middle Ages so that they belonged to Count so-and-so and mm-hmm. Duke so-and-so, mm-hmm. and they didn't belong to any of them. But in their mind, mm-hmm. they were following what they thought was this kind of medieval world. Yeah. Now, it had been planted in the United States, and in the United States, you saw a microcosm of this conflict between the old world and the new. Mm-hmm. And the North said the new world, and this comes out in the First World War II and later, right. the new world is going to obtain. It is going to win. Mm-hmm. There's going to be no plantation, no castles, none of it mm-hmm. is going to survive here. Right. It's going to be all one way, which is the modern way mm-hmm. and not the old way. Yeah. So I said rightly, as you mentioned, that was the first fascism mm-hmm. in the world. It didn't have the name fascism, but that's what they were trying to do.
And, you know, it's interesting how that plays out. When you think of 20th century nostalgic manifestations, that is, for example, calling all that you just described, quote, the lost cause. There's still that aura, you know, there's some great cause that had been lost. It's very romantically entwined, Gone with the Wind. I mean, these themes of grandeur.
They seem, yes, and chivalry. And they seem to take the same view that the, now if Southern listeners are listening to us, we're not castigating you now, but there is this idea in Europe with the far right that, as you say, mm-hmm. the loss, we are going to keep going about this thing, the lost cause, mm-hmm. Which we're sorry we lost and we'd like to revive it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in the South, with this business about the battle flags in Georgia, what is that? What is that? That is trying to reassert mm-hmm. the lost cause yeah. that they feel so warmly about.
Though that speaks to the power, again, as the book does, of these kind of romantic notions rooted in golden ages that never were, or at least were pretty awful for people at the bottom of them. And in fact, turning again to our 19th century brain, I really appreciate what you just brought in because that is a powerful contribution. I remember reading those pages three times. Mm. But Jews right. and anti-Semitism and right. specifically anti-Semitism resulting from making Jews a symbol of the great change. What does that mean?
Once again, George, you had mentioned that you had said to me, now, this was the 19th century, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Not the 20th century.
Not the 20th, no.
We have to go back once again to the 19th century. Mm-hmm. When I heard about Hitler, everything was the 20th century. Mm-hmm. The Jews, mm-hmm. as the villains of the Germans, began at the beginning of the 19th century. When the Germans began to resist modernization, they adopted the mythology of the Jew. Mm. The Jew was modernization in their minds. The Jew seemed
to be... In person.
Huh?
Modernization in person.
In person, yeah. Mm-hmm. They seemed to be able to work with the modern world. No mm-hmm. doubt they had their minds on probably these great Jewish financiers mm-hmm. who knew all about finance. But the little Jews coming out of Eastern Europe didn't know anything about that. Mm-hmm. So it was a rather a crude symbol, but... Mm-hmm. They had the background of the Christian anti-Semitism. So they knew Jews were a good group mm-hmm. to point to if you wanted to accomplish something and symbolize something. So out of Christian anti-Semitism, they took the new anti-Semitism.
This is excellent. Now, I think you partly answered one of the questions I was going to ask you, because this that is to say 19th century
right.
anti-Semitism, the identification of modernity becomes one of the prime movers in what Nazism ends up doing in terms of the Holocaust in the 20th
century. Yes, indeed.
Let me take a moment from our conversation, Martin Wang, to say this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Martin Wang. author of Hitler and the Holocaust, The Hidden Story, published by Ex Libris. A couple of questions as we come toward the end of our conversation, Martin. There's a portrait, and I use that word, of the young Hitler in this book that is fascinating because he's such a mediocrity. I mean, it's like this. I thought of him as a compound of inadequacies was my phrase.
He was.
He's a misogynist. He's right. An anti-Semite. Maybe the most colorful term is it got a pulp fiction mind, tabloid reading mediocrity. But here's the other point, the main point. I think it refers to something you mentioned earlier. In the Austria and then Germany of his time, wherever he went, wherever he lived, he was surrounded by what I call little Hitlers. I mean, there was like all these little marionette Hitlers
everywhere. No question about it. Before his time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the point is to maybe one of the ways is from this ultimately vast field, there was going to be a Hitler chosen, in a sense,
I think so.
To be the leader of Germany at some point. Another question, Martin. World War I.
Yeah.
And that's a vast topic. We could devote a program, a conversation, a book to it alone. Many books, I'm sure. But do you see it as many have called it a blunder or on the part of Germany a design to
more a design.
To do what?
I see. World War I was the first military reaction to modernization.
Mm-hmm.
Germany wanted to reinstall reaction throughout Europe. Austria wanted to do that. The World War I has been seen in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
I see it as the end result of the crisis of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
It absolutely, everything moved faster and faster and faster. Finally, it exploded. It exploded into a war that nobody would settle mm-hmm. on the old terms. Well, let's make a truce. You go back and we'll go back and we'll try again maybe some other time. No, mm-hmm. they said we should fight to the death. Why? Because they were fighting out principles and values.
Mm.
They weren't fighting out markets, as many historians say. They weren't fighting out territories, as many historians say. They were fighting out values.
It allowed for no compromise.
Huh?
It allowed for no compromise.
The world was either going to go forward or mm-hmm. it was going to go back.
Mm-hmm.
The Allies wanted the world to go forward.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans and their allies wanted the world to go back. The Germans were a monarchy. The Austrians were a monarchy. They were not democratic monarchies. They were parliamentary, in mm-hmm. quotes, monarchies, very retrograde.
Mm-hmm.
America was a real parliamentary republic. France was fighting to be that. England was.
Right.
And this was the conflict. It was the conflict between the old and the new. Mm-hmm. That's as I see it.
Which brings me to my concluding question, because it, based on what you've just said and on the book, and on that eternal question, why should anybody worry about history? That's old stuff. One answer could be this, and I guess I phrase it as a question. When you finish reading the book, in our times, my first thought was not Adolf Hitler, but Osama bin Laden.
Yes.
Because I kept
Absolutely.
Thinking the real issue here is how people can deal with modernity and how they can make use of the resentment of modernity and even turn that to violent, murderous
exactly.
passion. So is
that's right on the head. That's what's happening now with Mr. bin Laden. But I wanted to go back just a point about in summing up, I forget what you said, but I do bring it forward to the present time.
Right.
We are now advancing. The most modern culture in the world is advancing on a culture that's no more than 17th century. In the mass of its people, and we're telling them you have to go to Las Vegas to really get a flavor of America, and you got to look at TV with all of that. Hitler was a Puritan,
mm-hmm.
public Puritan as far as sex goes. He thought that all of this display of sexy sensuality was absolutely awful. Now, interestingly, modern conservatives think of it that way,
mm-hmm.
Christian fundamentalists think of it that way, and Muslim fundamentalists think of it that way. They all think the same thing.
Yeah.
So we are intruding on this old world, just as modernization intruded on old Europe in the 19th century. Oh, this is just what I wanted to say. There was an editorial in my local newspaper. And it was about a little girl who was killed in a snowmobile accident. It said, "The accidental death of a child is so tragic that we're reluctant to question the circumstances of such an awful occurrence. And yet the only thing more painful than one unnecessary death would be another unnecessary death because painful lessons were ignored." Now, one of the reasons I wrote this book, if we ignore the way modernization was introduced, the resentments it built up, the walls that it met, that built up to stop it, we will not explain the past and we will not understand the present.
And we'll be guilty for repeating mistakes.
We are repeating mistakes. Mm-hmm. And here's a story about one little girl I wrote about, a people, 6 million of the people were murdered. 50 million Europeans died. Mm-hmm. Something was wrong. And in the modern view, what was wrong was that Hitler was the devil incarnate. Mm-hmm. He wasn't otherworldly or anything like that. He was a human with a number of crazy traits, yeah. One of them being sociopathology, but others being very common.
That's right.
He was romantic. He was autistic. He was a reactionary. Mm-hmm. Those people are all around now. They're not killing everybody they view in sight. Mm-hmm. But he was also a sociopath, and he killed without conscience.
And that's what we should remember. That's what we should remember.
Well, we should remember the whole picture mm-hmm. of what happened. The picture was that an enormous opportunity was built up mm-hmm. for somebody to take advantage of. Mm-hmm. And it was almost made for madmen.
Right.
And Hitler stepped forward.
Stepped forward and took the blame.
Other people could have stepped forward, too, who mm-hmm. were almost as mad as Hitler. Friends of his who he knew.
Mm-hmm. The opportunity was there.
Yeah. This 19th century figure, Georg von Schönerer, mm-hmm. who was Hitler before Hitler. In 19th century Austria, he had the exact same ideas.
As did many others.
Wanted to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And wanted to kill all the Jews.
Martin Wang, thank you so much for being with us on Dialogue today. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Martin Wang, author of Hitler and the Holocaust, The Hidden Story. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. Our production assistant is Jordan Berg. And our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
To order a Dialogue program or for more information, contact us at 202-691-4146. You can also listen to Dialogue on the web at wilsoncenter.org/dialogue. Email us on America Online at radiodial@aol.com. That's RADIODIAL@AOL.com.